Hello, everyone. My name is Natalie Turvey. I'm president and executive director of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. It is my pleasure to welcome you to today's JTalks Live webcast, Emerging Business Models for News. Thank you for joining us for this timely discussion, delving into innovative and diverse revenue strategies that empower newsrooms to support informed and engaged communities. We are grateful to our exclusive JTalk series sponsor, TD Bank Group, for their year-round support. And our thanks also extends to our in-kind supporter, Cision, and to CPAC, our broadcast partner for this event. Before we begin our program, I would like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples of the lands that we are on today. While we meet on a virtual platform, the Canadian Journalism Foundation's office is situated on the traditional territory of many nations, including the Mississaugas of the Credit, the Anishinaabek, the Chippewa, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat peoples, and we are privileged to live and work in these territories. A quick reminder, our hour-long program today includes a Q&A session. Feel free to submit your questions for our speakers at any time via the tab on your screen. I also want to remind you that the CJF has another JTalks Live event planned in just 2 weeks on March 7th. In lead up to International Women's Day, we'll be presenting Reporting with Care, Ethical Journalism in the Shadow of Intimate Partner Violence, in partnership with the Canadian Women's Foundation. We hope you'll join us for this important discussion. You can visit our website for information on how to register. The landscape of journalism is currently facing daunting challenges. Just this month, we've witnessed the media industry in Canada grapple with significant upheavals marked by extensive layoffs and the selling of numerous outlets nationwide. And over the past year, we've seen the shuttering of notable digital entities like The Messenger, BuzzFeed News, and Jezebel, alongside workforce reductions at venerable institutions such as the Los Angeles Times, The Washington Post, and The Wall Street Journal. In an era characterized by cutbacks, diminishing ad revenues, and profound industry shifts, the quest for innovative and varied sources of income is more critical than ever. Today's discussion shifts the focus from these challenges to potential solutions. We are joined by a distinguished panel of pioneers who have carved out successful new pathways for revenue while also building and nurturing strong, informed communities of audiences. I am delighted to welcome our esteemed panelists to this timely conversation. Joining us from Val-David, Quebec, Drew Oyajay is the publisher of The Breach and executive director of CUTV. From Toronto, Anita Lee is the founder, editor-in-chief, and CEO of The Green Line. And joining us from San Antonio, Texas, Graham Watson Ringo is the vice president of success and growth with the News Revenue Hub, a nonprofit that supports local news outlets in creating strategies in their newsrooms to become profitable and sustainable. To lead our discussion, we're delighted to welcome media entrepreneur Brett Chang, who is also co-founder and CEO of The Peak here in Toronto. We're honored and grateful to our panelists for sharing their experience and their expertise with us today. I'll hand it over to Brett now to begin our conversation.
Thanks so much, Natalie. Thank you to all of our panelists, and thank you to all of you for tuning in to this very important subject. I'm excited to really dig into this. To start, I'd love just to go through each of our panelists and have them talk about what are their revenue streams and what's working today. And so we could probably start with Anita. We'd love to kind of hear what's happening at the Green Line and what's working for you on the revenue side.
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks for having me, everyone. I'm really delighted to be part of this conversation. That's super important. So the Green Line has a really diversified revenue stream. We really started recently investing in events, but the core of our revenue stream is actually partnerships. So if anyone here is familiar with El Tiempo, it is a publication in the US that has a business model that's quite similar to mine in the sense that they have never relied on large donors or single funders. And that's something that the Green Line has definitely followed in pursuit of. So essentially, we have a bunch of partners, including like City News Toronto, which is like a major broadcast partner of ours. We partner with a lot of cultural institutions, with educational institutions to unlock funding from academia. We've also partnered with grassroots organizations. So the Green Line is a for-profit news entity, but we basically partner with charitable organizations or nonprofits to act as our trustees so we can unlock funding for nonprofits. Also, one of the things that we're really investing in are events. So events, you know, everybody's talking about the rise of artificial intelligence and essentially, events in my mind really act as a solve against that, in the sense that especially my particular audience of young Torontonians, Gen Zs and millennials are really primed to gather in person. And there is a market opportunity and a market gap in Toronto in particular, where there's a lot of, you know, corporatized, more generic events, and a lot of grassroots events that are not highly produced. So the Green Line is trying to fill the middle portion where, or the market gap where basically there's a desire for events that are highly produced, but very, you know, more independent, more cool kid, if you will. So that's something that we're really investing in. And part of that also involves a partnership with an organization called Toronto Comedy All-Stars. And they're basically obviously a comedy organization that we partner with to produce events as a way to kind of funnel folks into our audience pipeline. And it's also a great way to actually build on our other revenue streams, which include membership and donations. So that's just a quick high-level overview.
Cool. That's really helpful. And Drew, with The Breach, what are you seeing work so far?
Yeah, so The Breach, for those not familiar, is, you know, our goal is sort of journalism for transformation. So we're really oriented toward an audience of folks who, you know, want to see some like pretty significant changes in the way our society, economy, and so on works. So we've really leaned into that, both in terms of our sort of building our audience, but also, you know, getting our audience into the, into the donor track, basically. So if you can put the slide up on the screen, if it's not already up there. So yeah, you can look at our breakdown. About 47% of our sort of revenue comes from our sustaining members. So this is about, we have about 35,000 people on our mailing list, and about 1,000 of those are recurring donors. So annual or monthly donors. Our average donation per month is about $1,350 or something like that. We feel pretty good about this almost 50%, especially if you look at the sort of, we're not dependent on any one other source, you know, particularly. We're happy to stay diversified and to stay aligned with our membership as much as possible. Obviously, the focus there is growing that 35,000 so that some significant percentage keeps becoming, you know, recurring donors. We have about 800 other people who've been sort of one-time donors. So, there's also converting them, convincing them to become more regular donors. And then, of course, increasing the amount. So this is, you know, this is the funnel in a nutshell. You know, I think we'd be much happier with the majority, if not all, of our revenue coming from readers. But obviously, that's not, you know, for a startup, that's not super realistic. And as it happens, like what we sort of realize is we set the goal of saying like, oh, we want 80% of our revenue to come from individual donors. But the problem is, as you grow as an organization, you also grow your other revenue streams. So it's hard to do it as a percentage, but nonetheless, we put the most focus on really moving those people through the funnel. So it starts with Facebook ads. Facebook and Instagram are really the main way that we've been able to acquire new readers. And we also do, you know, we've experimented with other platforms as well. And obviously there's a lot of word of mouth that goes on. So those are all the sort of key ways of bringing people in onto the mailing list, which is where people are most likely to become those donors. And then of course it's emailing them regularly, really emphasizing the value. And I guess I would just say as sort of a preview, you know, what has been the most, what people responded to the most, really, I think, is the impact of the journalism. When we can write big stories, and maybe I'll get into this a bit later, but when we can write, you know, stories that have a real impact in the world, like one story resulted in a parliamentary probe, for example. You know, Justin Trudeau was asked about a story in a press conference, which, you know, for a small outlet, like The Breach, is a big deal. And so we actually have him saying The Breach. And so, of course, we, you know, did a lead acquisition ad and did some fundraising off of that, for example. So people really respond to that sort of impact. I think also with our recent coverage of Palestine, I think people have really responded to the kind of, you know, rigorous and critical coverage that they can't find anywhere else or can't find many other places. Yeah, I think I'll leave it at there, but I think I would say impact is the main driver. There are some others as well, but that's our breakdown.
That close to 50% on donor revenue is very impressive, Drew. So you guys should be very proud of that. Graham, with the work that you do in the US, what type of revenue streams are you seeing work for publishers down south?
Yeah, so I mean, everything that both Drew and Anita talked about, it really resonates with me. I mean, the News Revenue Hub works with nearly 90 publishers, mostly in the United States. We do have one Canadian organization. And, you know, we really emphasize diversity in revenue streams. I mean, it's very important for us to have our organizations look for multiple ways to become sustainable. Ideally, we want that 25, 25, 25, 25. And, you know, if I have a slide here that talks about the risk and reward of different revenue streams. And so you can kind of see the revenue streams that we emphasize here. Obviously, it's philanthropy, advertising, reader revenue, and major donors. Events is in there, but events is so hit and miss for people. I think the issue for most of our publishers is the cost of events. You know, we've worked with a variety of organizations. Some do very high level events and do them incredibly well. Some do very low level events and do them incredibly well. And then some just don't want to wade into those waters at all. It's hard to secure, you know, funders for those things. It's hard to make money off of them. They're a really good funnel driver if you're trying to collect email addresses, but the revenue is usually break even or you come out a little bit in the red. So events, you know, we have a whole lab at the News Revenue Hub that just talks about events, but it's not because all of our organizations don't usually partake in them. We don't usually consider that in our you know, revenue pie when talking to organizations and talking about sustainability. But you can see here, you know, the News Revenue Hub doesn't believe in paywalls. We're very much about free access to quality journalism for the public. And that's very much what we stand for as a nonprofit. And so, you know, our goal is to help organizations get to that sustainability through ways that don't block access to news. And then some of the challenges of that on the other slide that I have, you know, our challenges every organization faces. If we could switch the slide to the challenges, these challenges that I talk about are challenges that are going to be familiar with anybody who's in journalism, right? You have competition. You have you know, the viral story that just sets your you know, your metrics sky high, and then you can't really like recuperate from that, right? Like you can't really balance it out the next year. But we do have like strategies when. You know, in Montana, they were, you know, dealing with a lot of flooding a year ago and really just trying to capitalize on that in a very sensible way that doesn't you know, really take away from the catastrophe that's going on. But also, you know, noting that the organization that's covering this is an important and viable resource, a vital resource for the community. So we see a lot of different things. I mean, the normal revenue slices are kind of the same for everybody. It's really just how you activate those slices that really make the difference here and really tell the difference between like a really sustainable organization and one that is struggling to make it.
That's really helpful. I, you know, you mentioned all these different diverse revenue streams. You want the 25, 25, 25, 25. What I think is challenging for a lot of publishers is when you make a decision to go down one of those paths that you laid out, how do you first experiment with that to ensure that you don't go too deep into it where you spend too much money on a revenue stream that actually won't produce the results that you're looking for? Anita, when you're talking about events, let's for example, how do you go about experimenting or dipping your toes into events to see if that's the right new revenue stream for your audience and your publication?
Yeah, so we have a model called an action journey. And part of an action journey is an event that we host that basically illuminates the systemic issue that we're covering in that given month. In the first year, we're in year two now, or approaching our 2 year anniversary. In our first year, it was a matter of testing the events out. So a lot of the way I reduced overhead was partnering with a lot of these cultural partners, these grassroots partners, these educational partners I was referring to. So we would get, you know, free venues and we get free promotions. And I'd start testing out like how to promote the events, what form of registration is the most effective, should there be a sliding scale in terms of payment, should there be certain events that are free or just more premium. And so in our second, in the latter half of last year, we started to host, we started to kind of level up the events based on the kind of feedback we were seeing earlier on. So for example, last year we hosted two events that were paid, one of which was a concert at the Great Hall in downtown Toronto that was basically about spurring the youth vote in the then municipal election here in Toronto. And that was nearly sold out, and we sold, you know, tickets on a sliding scale from like about $20 to $40. And then we replicated that same thing for a comedy event that we hosted in November that was totally sold out, that sold out over 250 tickets. And that was also in partnership with Toronto Comedy All-Stars, which I mentioned has a proven model. They already had something that was quite successful in terms of a comedy show. What we did was combine journalism and comedy. And so it was kind of it's basically reducing overhead by partnering with organizations that can reduce costs in terms of the events, so the risk is less, and also partnering with people that have some sort of proven model that already exists that you can kind of gel with and then develop something new out of it. So that's how we were able to mitigate any sort of like potential setbacks in terms of investing in events. And at the time, also another big thing is like having more robust revenue streams so that you can take risks and experiment in emerging ones. So I mentioned like partner revenue is actually, if we could go to the pie chart, because I wasn't able to show that before, I can actually show the audience really quickly that you can see the majority of our revenue is actually partner revenue. And so that is really sustainable on a regular basis and allowed me to experiment with donations and membership are still emerging because we're a really young organization. And then also with, we have a decent amount of government and foundation funding, government, not for content, but for actual like more infrastructural elements of the business that helped me start to experiment in more like B2C revenue, like events and merchandise and membership and donations.
That's really helpful. True. You know, I think we're talking about that membership revenue, which everybody wants to achieve, but you've actually done it. You've been able to hit almost half of your revenue through membership and donors. If you're a new publisher, there's a lot of journalists that are doing incredible work out there. They have new publications. They want to start collecting some of that member and donor revenue, but they run into a bit of a cold start problem. What recommendations would you have for them in order to get those first initial donors through the door to start building that new revenue stream?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, we were a little bowled over by the response out the gates. Like, I think we expected to start a lot, maybe not cold, but a lot cooler. But we did sort of a launch fundraiser, and we were able to get, you know, a bunch of people who, you know, maybe people in this audience may have never heard of, with the exception of, I guess you would have heard of a few, Naomi Klein, David Suzuki, Avi Lewis, a few folks like that. We got on a video among some other sort of luminaries among the audience that we were aiming to reach. And so we really leveraged basically everything we had in terms of calling in favors and contacts and all this stuff. I think that really paid off, having that sort of social validation of like, it's not just like, oh, this is some journalist that maybe heard of one time. It's like, no, there's a journalist that, you know, hopefully you have, if you're starting a new local news outlet, just for example, you have yeah, you have the person who's the sort of driving force, but then you maybe you also have a local former elected representative or former or like, you know, well-known columnist or radio commentator or whatever it is, some kind of local personality or ideally a bunch, and you get them, you know, very visually engaged in terms of the public-facing promotions. I would say that's one big factor, is that sort of, yeah, social validation of the value of what you're doing. You know, otherwise, I think it's good. The launch is really the moment when something's new, it's the kind of easiest publicity you're going to get. You know, it's going to get much harder as you go down the line of, you know, as you're like a year or 2 years in, like, it's like, okay, well, we heard about that thing, but it's not new anymore. But that moment of newness is really key. And so I think it's really important to leverage, sort of to call in all the favors that you can at that moment, and get all, consolidate as much support as you can, you know, going into that moment, but then, you know, really literally launch yourself into the public eye. Maybe not literally launch yourself, but, you know, strongly figuratively launch yourself. So yeah, I guess that would be my sort of main recommendations for someone starting out. Obviously having really good coverage, you know, coming out of the gates, like maybe save up a few key, you know, really splashy stories. If you can, you know, if you're incubating your sort of idea for a few years, maybe really keep an eye out for those sort of eye-catching or impactful stories that really exemplify the best of what you feel like you can accomplish. And you can use the sort of pre-launch period to really concentrate that and save up that. Trying not to use a war metaphor here, but save up that stock of good stories, and then, you know, bring them out in the, you know, in the first, in that moment when people are paying attention and setting their impression of what you're doing. I think is really that first month or so is key, where when people are, you know, sort of first impressions are going to last a long time. And if in month 6 or 7, you maybe have a slower sort of, you know, news output, people aren't going to notice nearly as much as if that happens in month 1 or 2. So again, sort of really saving up the sort of best stories that you have, coupled with the social validation, coupled with the, like, you know, really putting effort into getting the word out there, not just being like, oh, they put out this thing and then you go focus on the stories. No, like, you, I think you really want to make the launch count. And then after that, I think it's a question of, you know, of really demonstrating the value to people. And, you know, you just have to remind people all the time what the value is. Like with the breach, we don't have, you know, we don't have a paywall. We don't have advertisers. And so, you know, that's obvious to us, but it's not necessarily obvious to our audiences. And so we really try to remind them all the time. Like we don't do these things. We rely on you. You know, you are the sort of, you know, key mover. And even if you do have advertising and stuff, you know, you can, in our case, it's like, it's the independence that we're able to have to cover things in a way that they don't get covered elsewhere. Certainly on an issue like Palestine, for example, I think that's really important for our audience. And so again, we have to remind them of that, say like, look, like we're able to, it's because of you that we're able to have this independence, that we're able to do this coverage that you clearly value. And so don't think of anything as obvious. You know, you have to really build the narrative. Like it's easy to take for granted that, you know, because as the journalist, as the you know, publisher or whatever your role is, like, you're going to be facing this stuff every day, and so it's obvious to you, but the key is to remember that it's not obvious to anybody else, and so to make that really visible to everybody what impact their contributions have and how valuable that is to you, but also to the civic life of their community or whatever your value proposition is.
Yeah, I think that's very tactical and helpful for anybody who's getting going now. So thank you for that. Graham, you were going through the different revenue streams that you recommend that the publishers that you work with use or at least experiment with. How do you think about contingency planning in case one of those streams goes dry? Let's say grants, for example. How do you advise your publishers if they're thinking about the worst case scenarios?
Now, you never want to be reliant on grants, foundation money. I mean, I've always said, like, you don't want to be reliant on the whims of rich people. They change, you know, their priorities change. They may want to fund diversity today and then want to fund puppies tomorrow. So, you know, that is not a reliable revenue stream. And as much as you can get away from the over-reliance, I mean, I think as independent news organizations, you're always going to have some reliance on grants, some reliance on foundations. I mean, that is where the bulk of the money is. But if you can make it less than 70%, 80%, which I've seen in a lot of organizations, less than 50%, this is really something that we endeavor to do for a lot of news organizations, because that money does dry up. A three-year grant may be great in the interim, but you're not going to get another one on top of that. It's just the whole reason for these grants is to set you on a good foot and then send you off into the world, right? So that you can go be independent and you can stand on your own 2 feet. So if you don't make the most of whatever that three-year grant is, and then you come back hat in hand, you know, a year afterward and say, you know what, actually we could use another $100,000, you're probably not going to get it. And they're going to wonder what you did with the money they gave you in the first place. So, use that grant money to build up your other revenue streams. Think about what Drew said. You know, everything that Drew says is right on, right? You're building a trust with your readers. When you're doing a membership program or any sort of reader revenue contribution program, you're building this trust. So, you know, if you're going to tell people that you're going to do a newsletter twice a week and it's going to come out Monday at 7 a.m., it better not come out at Monday at 9 a.m. because you've already broken that trust. Your job is to make yourself an indispensable part of somebody's life so that they feel like they need you if you're gone, right? So, you know, you're really trying to create this bond between you and your audience, and so much so that they will willingly open their wallets and pay you. I used to be a managing editor for a nonprofit here in San Antonio. It was called the Rivard Report. It's now called the San Antonio Report. And I had come from for-profit. I didn't know anything about nonprofit news. And we did an event. It was a town hall. And a woman walked up to me, shook my hand, told me how wonderful she thought our work was. And then she handed me a $20 bill. And I just sort of was like, okay, great, thanks. Not sure what to do with this. Obviously, our business manager took it out of my hand. She goes, I know what to do with it. But that was just like, it was unfathomable to me, coming from for-profit where everything is clickbait and everything is, you know, chasing clicks, chasing advertising, things like that. To have somebody actually pay me for doing good journalism. And that's really the crux of this. Just do great journalism and people will want to support you. Advertising, I don't subscribe to like programmatic. I mean, these are direct sales. These are classy ads that jive with the content that you're producing and they're advertisers that believe in the things that you do. You know, that's hit and miss, but I think there's a good bit of revenue that can come from that, including sponsorship revenue, things like that. So, you know, really building up these other revenue streams, figuring out where you align mission-wise with advertisers, where you align mission-wise with sponsors, where you align mission-wise with events. You know, we held an event in our office. We officed out of an 1800s, pre-1800s building that was on the other side of the railroad track. So it was a segregation hotel. And people would love to come into our office because it was very historic. And then we contracted with local artists. We had them put their art on the wall and we made it kind of this like event where we had it, we traded for food and beverage. We had the art on the wall. The artists were all in house so they could talk about all of their art. Everything was for sale. And you got to mingle with all of the reporters, which do not underestimate what kind of rock stars your reporters are. I mean, reporters are just, I can't tell you how many times I had somebody come up to me, ask me like, hey, where's that one reporter? I'm like, oh, he's over there in the corner. And they'd be like, oh my gosh, I can't believe it. Like, they are the lifeblood of your organization. and utilizing them in any way that makes sense. I'm not trying to like cheapen them or anything like that, but you know, anything that makes sense where, you know, if you have a reporter that's very good at business and is looked to and everybody loves their business content, think about writing a newsletter with that person. You know, think about having them host an event that they conceive of, right? So they have ownership in it too. All of these things, it's really, you know, the things that Drew is saying, the things that Anita is saying, those all take capacity. So you really have to look beyond just your marketing or your membership manager or your development director or your CEO and things like that, and incorporate your entire staff and get them all on board to try and raise revenue, because it can't just be a few people on the business side who are raising revenue. It's got to be really an in-house or support kind of task, because that wall that used to exist between, like, and still probably does exist a lot in like mainstream newspapers, between editorial and business, that can't exist in independent, right? That you really need to have that cohesive unit all working toward one goal, because you need the journalism to make the money, and then you need the people who can get you the money to rely to need the journalism. So you need both of those things working cohesively to really have a stable, sustainable business model that can then incorporate all those different revenue pieces.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I'd love to kind of go to some of the audience questions as they're coming in, and feel free to ask any questions in the chat. We've got a document that we're updating all of them with, and we'll try to get to as many as we can before the end of the panel. I'd love to start with what Brian asked, which is, are there any funding or financing options to help an online news startup while ad revenue and sponsorships grow? I'd love to get Anita's input on this, considering that you recently did start this new publication, and there was a point, obviously, where you started it, and then you had to figure out how to grow it without the ad revenue or sponsorship revenue at the outset. And so how did you go about that, and what financing have you seen work for new publications?
So yeah, that's a great question. I bootstrapped my publication. I come from a middle class family. I didn't have like a, you know, ton of spare money to create a local news outlet. So for me, it was actually investing in myself, first of all. I also, and that's the one thing I really want to emphasize before even going into the revenue streams, is like, I was somebody who came, I worked at The Globe, The Star, CBC, CTV, and Legacy Canadian Media, and then I worked at youth-led digital media in the States. So I kind of merged these two sensibilities and combined that with like a lot of my community-focused, solutions-focused journalism desires and a desire to kind of fulfill that mission. And I had a really clear vision. So from the outset, even as I was developing the publication, even everything from the design to the way we like worded our value propositions in the site, I had already consulted people for my target audiences, even in that early process, even before the journalism was produced. So for me, just to reiterate something Drew said, was just like having a really clear focus in serving your audience. But needless to say, I like invested in myself, and I think like as a result of like the clear focus and the fact that I was filling a gap in Canadian media at the time, there weren't a lot of outlets that were that had my particular mission of helping young Torontonians survive and thrive in a rapidly changing city through this particular community-driven model. There was some initial early attention that allowed me to unlock like early funding from, and like Graham said, like early funding from like a foundation. So InSpirit Foundation, I had a prior relationship with them. They were generous enough to invest in my idea even before the website had launched. It was a small amount of seed funding, but it was enough for me to be able to produce content. And another thing I did, and I can't like emphasize this enough, is like partnerships. So I'm also a journalism innovator in residence at Toronto Metropolitan University, and I meet a lot of really brilliant young journalistic minds who are eager to, you know, be part of something new and interesting and innovative. So I was able to, you know, source like ethically sourced labor from these young people. I paid them. They were also like, they also often got school credit. To produce the kind of journalism that I know would define our organization. And at the time it was I, you know, because of C-18, you can't really access this anymore if you're Canadian. But they were cool Instagram kind of formats that replicated newspapers that were kind of almost livable or moving newspapers where we basically produced our stories. So it was a combination of kind of like having a really clearly defined mission and aesthetic, that served a particular audience that initially got those initial kind of grant dollars in the door, and then also appeal to partners. And so that was the slow build for me, just kind of like earning trust from all these different communities that said, yes, I'm going to invest in this idea. That allowed me to invest in the content and then keep kind of producing that kind of content that really reinforced our value proposition and just reinforced like what we do. And that's still the approach we're going. Like we don't generate any advertising revenue. It's not something that I'm pursuing as of yet. And sponsorships and corporate sponsorships in particular are a newer thing for us as well. So, but this has been working out for us so far. So I'm just going to continue going down that path.
That's helpful. And Graham, you mentioned on the advertising front that you weren't a fan of programmatic advertising, and I think everybody can understand why that is, and that you prefer the publications do direct sales. John asks, what is the most efficient strategy for reaching out to potential sponsors? What have you seen work with some of the publications that you're close with?
Again, I mean, I think you need to figure out, who mission aligns with you. You want to have advertisers that are going to resonate with your readers, and your readers are, obviously it's the content that you're producing. So what advertisers make sense within the framework of your content? Then you need to go find those advertisers. You need to, I mean, this is a cold list, cold leads, warm leads kind of list, right? It's almost the same way you'd find grant funders. You would make an entire list of every single person or every single organization, every single business that would make sense for your organization. And then you make the phone calls. I know it's not glamorous. There's no magic here. It's really beating the street and going out and asking. And then, creating a media kit. Don't come empty-handed. Don't send, emails without having a media kit that shows why your organization is the right place for their advertising, how many people you're reaching. You really need to dive into those metrics and tell people, how many people you're reaching, what demographics you're reaching, what zip codes you're reaching, things like that. Sorry, zip codes applicable in Canada. I appreciate it. I apologize. But those types of things, right? So, I think it's really important to make your business as attractive to an advertiser as possible, but make sure you don't want to sell your soul here. Like you don't need the money that badly. Despite what you may feel inside and how much trepidation you might have about the health of your business, like you don't need the media or the money that badly to compromise your ethics or compromise your news or anything like that. So I think it's always really important to sit there and look at what organizations and what advertisers are mission aligned. Create that list and then start cold emailing. I would always start with people that you know. So if you know advertisers, if you have, look at your, if you have donors, if you have reader revenue coming in, look at people who might already be attached to those advertising spaces and start calling them because they already have a fondness for your organization. Look on your newsletter list. See who's subscribing to your newsletter. Look for those at such and such dot, organization. See if there's anybody on those lists because already they've taken an interest in your organization, so they are more likely to help you on the advertising front, and those become warmer leads than just like cold calling people.
Yeah, that's how I got started. And it is definitely not glamorous, I can confirm. We've got a question here from Tim, and it's to Drew, but I'd love to get Anita's thoughts on this as well, because it's something affecting all publications in Canada. But are you caught by the C18 Meta ban? And if so, how are you still building your mailing lists, advertising on Meta, or pivoting to other acquisition channels? We can start with Drew, but again, I'd love to get Anita's thoughts on this after.
We are caught by the ban, and while there's no love lost between the various Zuckerberg-owned enterprises and us, we are unfortunately still very dependent on Facebook for our lead generation ads. It's definitely something that we're working very hard to figure out an alternative to. Like we're trying all kinds of things, but the sad fact of the matter is that there's just nothing as effective. Or cost effective specifically, in terms of advertising options. So we're still giving them a lot of money, even though they're blocking us on every other front. And that is a sort of a loophole, I guess. They'll let you pay for access to audiences, but they won't let you get it, access your audience directly for free. In terms of just in terms of the overall impact, I will say that there have been some like not terrible benefits. I think at least in the short term, the government did put in some special measures for journalism that did give, I think, a decent chunks of cash to a bunch of different small outlets that really needed it, especially in the wake of this sort of ban. I think it has sort of forced us to reckon with the overall situation. We've tried to sort of address it as proactively as possible. We got together with a whole bunch of other independent publishers, like 20 other independent publishers, and launched a new platform called Unrigged. You can find it at unrigged.ca, but it basically is an aggregator of all the different, all those different, news sources. So basically a one-stop shop for independent news, and obviously we're expanding the list of people and outlets that are on there. But there's also podcasts and video and stuff. But the point is, we're trying to be proactive in terms of saying, okay, there is this platform that people sort of were implicitly relying on to get news, and what's going to replace it? And so we're sort of throwing our hat in the ring in terms of that. But yeah, I'll let Anita take it from there.
Yeah, we definitely were impacted, and I was hoping we were going to fly under the radar. And in fact, there's at one point we tried, because we are a community-based journalism organization, and I see us way more than a content provider, given the holistic way we serve our audiences. We tried to change it to community organization, and it just did not work. And that wasn't ideal, because obviously Instagram, for especially young Torontonians, Gen Zs, and millennials, that's like probably the main source of the way they consume the news, right? So that's actually why part of the reason why we're investing so heavily in events. It was already a core part of our model, but we're able to collect hundreds of email addresses and per event, depending on the scale and size of the event, of course, through, for example, Eventbrite ticket sales. So that's and obviously getting their emails and getting them funneling them to our newsletter is actually a way to kind of just have another a deeper and more engaged touch point with our audience. So that's one approach. The other thing is, at the time before, I know we're still in the process of resolving things with Google with regards to C18, but YouTube has never been part of the ban. And it's something that also, again, appeals to our audience, but appeals to even broader age segments. And so because of our partnership with City News Toronto, excuse me, because of our partnership with City News Toronto, we are already producing a lot of video content. And so it just makes sense to actually adapt that content for a YouTube channel. And that's, again, reducing our overhead and also developing our audience in another platform that's just not blocked. And then also, we also do get, in some ways, even though the audience on City News Toronto is an older demographic, we effectively get free advertising through them, because we co-produce a community show with them that airs every 2 weeks on Fridays. And people air City, like, not only in their households, but also like in restaurants and in public spaces. So that's definitely a way we've been able to kind of just amplify our brand out there.
And just to end off the panel on a more positive note, we've got a question from Emily here. In the last decade, we have seen various alternative revenue streams replace the traditional three-pronged approach. That would be newsstands, sales, subscriptions, ads. What alternative revenue streams do you see coming down the pipeline? And I'll add to that, what revenue streams are you most excited about? And we'll start with you, Graham.
Wow. I think SMS is really growing. SMS, WhatsApp, Discord, using these alternative social media sites and services to reach people where they are. Now, if you really want me to get wild, I do a startup lab run by Philip Smith, and we saw a lot of the Canadian participants really thinking about print, which kind of blew me away a little bit. But not doing print in your traditional way of like stodgy newspaperism, but like really, a few page kind of circular that you're handing out to people, at community centers, at places where people who couldn't maybe or aren't traditionally, able to receive news, maybe because of economic circumstances or things like that. I see that as maybe, and then there's always the nostalgia factor. I mean, Taylor Swift made the 90s cool again, right? So, the baggy pants and things like that. Like, why is it not possible that print could come back? I know it seems wild, but you'll remember you heard it here first. So, I think that looking at new, because you're dealing with C18 here. We don't have that in the United States yet. But the downturn on how much traction people are getting from Facebook is almost nil. So people are having to pivot and really starting these WhatsApp groups to meet people where they are, SMS groups to deliver like timely news. And Outlier Detroit, a media outlet in Detroit, is really creating an SMS platform that can pinpoint somebody like to their street and to their intersection to like say, hey, don't go through there. There's going to be construction here. So really using it as journalism that is more like helpful daily journalism rather than like news gathering per se. And just thinking of different ways to do the business differently. Thinking journalism isn't always just big news stories. Journalism can be any number of things that are helping people in their daily lives. So I think sometimes we just need to think outside the box a little bit and figure out what models are really going to move the needle most with the people who are consuming our the products we're producing as news outlets.
I love the idea of print. I think we should bring print back.
I love print.
Drew, what are you excited about that the breach has going on the revenue side?
I mean, one thing that we're really interested in right now is trying to figure out how to deepen our engagement. I think there's a lot of when you quantify things, it's easy to sort of slip into quantitative and just being like more numbers. But it's also like, okay, what's the depth of the engagement? I think the sort of interest, the renewed interest in print and in-person events really speaks to that. You just the amount of the depth of the quality of an engagement that you get when you have like a physical object in your hands or actual human beings in front of you, not mediated by digital interface, is big. And so we're interested in sort of segmenting our list and finding ways to engage more deeply with people and sort of find ways that actually make sense to them to deepen their engagement with the project. And that could take any number of pathways, whether it's coming to an event, whether it's talking to organizing an event or having a few people over to have a discussion group or something like that. Just finding ways to sort of deepen the engagement among that list and not just focus. Obviously, we want to keep focusing on growing that audience, but think about what we can do with the audience that we have. And then I would really, in terms of print, certainly publishing is something that we're very interested in. I'm not gonna give away too many half-baked plans here, but certainly it's something that we're sort of looking at in terms of something that really aligns. I think the key is finding ways in our case to align with what we're already sort of known for, what people think of us as, think of our strengths as being, and so on. And so I think that there are opportunities to be pursued there as well. And of course, in-person events. I think Graham and Nita have a lot more experience with it and have talked about it a lot more. It's a little more difficult for us as a sort of a publication that spans like thousands of kilometers in terms of our audience, but they are concentrated in the big cities, and I think there's a big opportunity there to get people in the same room and thinking and discussing together in ways that we haven't been able to do yet. So that's exciting as well.
Well, your answer prompted another question that I'm going to have to ask at the end. I know I said that was the last one, but Anita, I would love to kind of hear your perspective of what new revenue streams in media are really exciting to you.
Yeah, absolutely. So Graham mentioned one in particular that I'm really interested in pursuing, which is SMS. I have a lot of love for accountability and investigative journalism, but that's not the Green Line's focus or specialization. We do a lot of engagement-driven journalism, and we try to be as service-oriented as possible at a hyper-local level. So again, definitely want to echo what Graham mentioned around never discounting like the value of just providing simple information that helps people navigate their lives, and that's really what we strive to do. And so going into SMS might be a really interesting way to just reinforce the mission that we already have at the Green Line. The other thing that we're doing is it's kind of playing on or building on our expertise in in-person events and the engagement-driven, community-driven journalism that we do. And we're actually launching an engagement outpost in downtown Toronto in Alexandra Park. Alexandra Park is actually an area that has a lot of newcomers and young people. It's more low income. And so we've partnered actually with a community center there called Scadding Court Community Center that has this really cool series of entrepreneurial hubs that are essentially shipping containers that are returned turned into food stalls. So we're actually setting up shop to have a physical location, the first, I guess you could say, Green Line physical outpost, where we're going to basically break bread with local community members and gather information from them, having conversations. And we're also actually training some youth journalists on how to report on their neighborhood. So that is, we were able to get funding for that. And if the model is successful, which I'm optimistic it will be, then we can continue to get funding to fund this project, but also it'll help just reinforce or hopefully grow our budding like membership and donation-based revenue streams by really focusing on reporting on journalism or reporting on news that our community tells us that they care about.
Cool. We got a bunch of questions coming in about this, and Drew's answer prompted me to ask this in the last few minutes here. But in terms of AI, both on the publishing side, but also in terms of revenue, how are each of you thinking about the impact on your business and your publication? Graham, I'd love to start with you and what some of the publications that you work with, how are they thinking about the rise of AI?
Wow. So AI comes up a lot, and we have to be really careful about what we're suggesting because it's still in its infancy. We don't want to lead anybody down too dark of a pathway at this point, but I think there's opportunity to add capacity for organizations, and that's big. One of the things that I really am passionate about is organizations that are kind of lower capacity, lower, starting out organizations that don't have a lot of money and don't have a lot of capacity, and how they can grow their capacity and start, really raising their game a little bit. And I think AI is one way to do that. I think you can use it in a variety of ways to add capacity to editing. I think you can add capacity to fact checking. I know Google recently released some additional tools for that, and then we use it. We and the Hub use it when we're helping organizations, make the most out of their donation asks, their newsletter asks, their newsletter toppers, things like that really hit home and making sure they're still jiving with their value propositions. So we're very much cautiously dipping our toe into it. I know there's a lot of organizations. If your organization works on Newspack, I know they have joined forces with NODA, which is an AI organization that helps write newsletters in a more succinct way. Takes them from your site, grabs pieces of your metadata, and makes them into newsletters. I mean, I think that's cool, but I mean, nothing's ever going to trump a human. Nothing's ever going to trump like the oversight of a human. So I think that's where we need to tread lightly on this, is that all these things are great for adding capacity and making our jobs easier, but overall you still need a human eyes to fact check it. You still need human eyes to make sure that everything is going out the way that it should. But I do think there's a lot of promise there in terms of making our jobs a little bit easier.
And Anita, how are you thinking about AI?
Yeah, I think about it this a lot, and I've actually integrated AI into some of our business development practices. So recently we actually got a grant of $50,000 through with the like, and I used AI to assist me in this. Of course, it's like all my original ideas, but it helped basically reduce the very arduous experience of putting together a grant and likely reduce the number of hours I would have invested into this from like 40 to like 4 hours. So I like Graham am like cautious about this. And I also think nothing can really replicate human oversight. I do think it is, there's a lot of, but I also don't love the fear mongering because I think it's really important to really think critically about how we can apply ethics to AI in journalism and embrace it in a cautious way so as not to like have bad actors define that for us, but also because I do think, especially for independent outlets that don't have major funders like my own, it can be incredibly helpful from an operations and, like I said, business development standpoint. So far, we haven't used it in any of our journalism. And I do think down the line, I think as AI grows its influence on journalism, I think editing and fact-checking will become of utmost importance. So yeah, that's my take on it. Just basically being cautious but making sure that you, as a journalist, experiment with it, because I think just avoiding it altogether is not a good approach.
And to close us out, Drew, how are you and The Breach thinking about AI applications at your publication?
Yeah, honestly, I don't think we've discussed it as a group, but just on a personal level, I will say that, you know, certainly being very cautious about any kind of final product. I definitely would not want to copy and paste anything from any kind of AI into anything that I put out to the public. But that said, I think on the sort of back end, I think it can sort of speed things up in terms of like, if there's a format of a pitch deck or a presentation or something, and you just want to like get some very like standard idea of what that format is or how to think about it, then something like ChatGPT can definitely like get you on the track to like, you know, not just staring at a blank page, but having a bit more of a something to respond to, basically. It's good for sort of, you know, getting ideas out there. I can be like, give me, you know, 20 subject lines for an email about this, and I probably won't use any of them because they're not very good. But there might be something in there that might spark an idea that I hadn't thought of, or it, you know, it's just kind of like, it's like having a not very smart person to bounce ideas off of, which obviously having a smart person to bounce ideas off of, or even a person at all, is much, much better. But in a pinch, you know, a tool like Perplexity, I definitely find myself experimenting, with, you know, a sort of a search engine I can ask questions to. It's not, you know, it probably shaves like a few minutes off of like a Google search. But it can be very helpful in terms of finding new sources. And then of course you have to go read the sources and figure out if it's actually saying anything accurate about them, but it can sort of get you to that place a little bit faster. So it's good, you know, it can be sort of helpful, can also not be helpful, in certain circumstances when you're trying to research something quickly, or just get a sense of something. Pretty cautious, but it's, you know, it's like a, it's a tool to be used, well before anything goes public.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much. That brings us to time. Thank you so much to our panelists for all their great insights and commentary on this very important topic. Thank you for all of you for tuning in, and thank you for the CJF for hosting us. That brings us to the end of this JTalk, but I really appreciate all of your time and appreciate all of our panelists today.